Our next speaker, Peter Muir, is an acknowledged authority. Let's hold on a second. Let's get the mic here. Thank you. Our next speaker, Peter Muir, is an acknowledged authority on American vernacular music, whose book, Long Lost Blues, Popular Blues in America, was published in January by the University of Illinois Press. With a PhD in musicology, he has produced scholarly articles for numerous publications and encyclopedias, including, the list is way too long here, I'm sorry. Okay. He's a former lecturer at City University of New York and head of keyboards at Westminster School, London. And I see we have a keyboard here with us today. So this looks like a particular...
piano attached to it.
And the piano attached to it, that's right. His talk is called Long Lost Blues, the Early Blues Industry in America. So as soon as we get it going, let's give it up for Peter Muir.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Here is the book. It looks like this. This is the only copy that's available here right now, but you can order it very inexpensively, so from the sheet they have there. So I'm going to start off just talking a little bit about the book and then go into specific presentation for today. The book is about what happened when blues emerged from the black subculture and spread into the American mainstream in the second decade of the 20th century. The result was the rise of the genre I call popular blues. Popular blues were produced in great numbers. In the period covered by this talk and the book, the first 9 years of production, 1912 through to 1920, over 450 blues appeared on sheet music and recordings. Certain of these were among the best-selling songs of the era. By the end of the decade, if not before, blues had become a staple of the mainstream entertainment industry and had made its way into musicals, revues, circuses, minstrel shows, and vaudeville. The creators of these blues included some of the best-known music talent of the day, including W.C. Handy, Spencer Williams, James P. Johnson, George W. Thomas, and Perry Bradford, along with dozens of others less well-known. This paper is in two parts. In the first, I will outline the overall scope and explosive development of the blues industry in its first 9 years from 1912 to 1920, focusing particularly on the role of recordings in that era. In the second part, I will celebrate our current location and discuss new evidence demonstrating a New Orleans influence on the most celebrated popular blues of the period, W.C. Handy's Memphis Blues. W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. We start then with the blues industry itself. Now, for this, you'll need the handout, which looks like... Have you all got the handout now?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'll talk very slowly. Popular blues effectively begins in 1912 with the publication of a song called simply The Blues, written by two African-Americans, Chris Smith and Tim Brumman, and published by the major New York firm of Shapiro Music. Three other blues, I'm talking really slowly now, because you're just about to refer to table one on the... Three other blues appeared in print that year, and now looking at table one on the handout. The three were, in chronological order of appearance, Baby Seals Blues by H. Franklin Baby Seals, Dallas Blues by Hart A. Wand, and W.C. Handy's The Memphis Blues. A fourth, Negro Blues by Leroy Lass's White, was copyrighted in 1912, but not published until the following year under the title, well, you can imagine what that title was, you got it there. Thereafter, published blues appeared on a continuous and increasingly frequent basis, so that by 1920, the genre had become a major offshoot of the popular music industry, with a new title appearing an average of every 2 or 3 days. The rapid growth of the early popular blues industry is shown in Table 2 on your handouts. It lists the total number of blues titles published in sheet music and or on recordings for each year between 1912 and 1920. We can see that the two biggest years of growth are 1916 and 19. That would be the first column gives that. The column on the right gives the aggregate, the total number of blues produced so far. 1916 and 1919, both these years more than doubling the output of the preceding year. By the end of 1920, no fewer than 456 blues had appeared on sheet music and recordings. As this is a conference centered around sound recordings, I would like to discuss the question of early blues recordings in a little detail and its relationship to the sheet music industry. Popular blues were extensively recorded on all the major media of the day: discs, cylinders, and player piano rolls. In terms of discs and cylinders, nearly 400 blues recordings are known from the period, and there exist at least the same number of piano rolls. I should add that a full discography and rollography of these are posted on the book's website. The book is called Long Lost Blues, and the book's website is longlostblues.com. There are, therefore, upward of 800 known blues recordings in the pre-1921 period. The growth of popularity of blues records is shown by Table 3, which gives the total number of grooved recordings, discs and cylinders, as opposed to piano rolls, you need to turn the page over, for each year before 1921. As you can see, there is little activity in the first half of the decade, just 6 recordings up to the end of 1915. But thereafter, there is rapid growth, with a total of 385 recordings having been made by the end of 1920. Blues records from the period show a wide variety. They last anywhere from around a minute and a half for a 5-inch Little Wonder to over 4 minutes for the large 12-inch size format. The predominant format for blues records, as with most other vernacular music of this period, was, of course, the 10-inch size, which, as I'm sure you all know, played at about 3 minutes a side. Blues records of the era show a wide range of arrangements: vocal recordings, usually solo, though some duets, and typically backed by a full band, and instrumental variations for various kinds of band, such as military jazz, Hawaiian combos, and instrumental soloists with accompaniment. And though the large majority of performers were white, there are a fair number made by African Americans, including band leaders like W.C. Handy, James Reese Europe, and Ford Dabney, and vocalists such as Burt Williams. These records varied greatly in popularity. Some, for smaller labels, probably had minimal sales, but certain of them sold exceptionally well. Records like the original Dixieland Jazz Band's Livery Stable Blues from 1917, the first jazz record ever made, were among the best-selling records of the day and greatly helped the dissemination of blues as a genre. This raises an important question. If blues were disseminated in the mass marketplace through both sheet music and recordings, which was the more important of the two media? This is a question central to our understanding of the blues industry in these years, but it is not an easy one to answer. When the popular music industry started up in the late 1800s, it was driven entirely by sheet music, for the simple reason that that was the only available mass medium. However, with the rise of commercial recordings in the 1890s, that situation began to shift. Given that today the music industry is record-driven, there was obviously some point of crossover when records began to gain the upper hand over sheet music. In fact, it would seem that the crossover point was reached in precisely the period covered by my book, the 19-teens. According to the U.S. Census of Manufacturers, in 1909, the total sales of sheet music slightly exceeded the combined sales of recorded media. $5.5 million, that's for the year, as compared with $5.2 million. By 1914, however, that situation had reversed quite dramatically. $11.9 million worth of annual sales from recordings, but only $6.8 million from sheet music. And by 1919, that trend had increased further, with $47.8 million earned from recordings, but only $12.5 million from sheet music. It seems clear then that recordings were more important economically than sheet music in the music industry of the 19-teens. That is as far as the general music industry is concerned. But what about the blues industry? Here things are more complex. Popular blues emerged originally as a sheet music phenomenon in 1912. The first disc recordings were not made till 2 years later. But I strongly suspect that by the end of the decade, say by 1919, when blues had become thoroughly integrated into the mainstream music industry, that recordings dominated commercially, just as they did for the industry as a whole. When the crossover happened, however, is impossible to determine with any precision. My best guess would be around 1918. The discussion between blues sheet music and recordings has so far only dealt with the commercial aspect. But what about the creative? Here, the answer is quite clear. Of the 456 blues from before 1921, almost all, 96%, appeared as sheet music, while less than half, 42%, were recorded. Furthermore, 58% of blues appeared only as sheet music. That is, they were never recorded. By comparison, only 4% of blues appeared only on recordings. That is, they were never published as sheet music. So when popular blues of the 19-teens were created, they were almost always produced first on sheet music and only recorded after the fact. It is therefore no exaggeration to say that in terms of creativity, early popular blues was a medium that was essentially sheet music based. This is confirmed by the nature of blues recordings from the 19-teens. In these, the music is performed relatively straight, with close adherence to the original. The creative input of the performer is thus secondary to that of the composer, as was the norm generally in recordings of that era. This is in sharp contrast to innumerable jazz and blues records of the 1920s and beyond, where the performer assumes a far greater creative prominence over and independence from the composition being performed. There are some notable exceptions, however. Perhaps the most striking is the aforementioned original Dixieland jazz band's Livery Stable Blues. What makes Livery Stable Blues so different from all popular blues that went before it is that it's the first to be conceived around live performance. The farmyard calls, which are the work's most distinctive feature, the crowing clarinet, neighing cornet and the mooing trombone, as well as the frantic drive and exuberant polyphony of the jazz-based performance, are poorly reflected in the published sheet music. Furthermore, that sheet music was not copyrighted till some months after the record was made, a most unusual procedure at the time, confirming that this was the case. In this case, the printed version was secondary to the recorded. Livery Stable Blues was an indicator of things to come. So much canonic material recorded by blues artists of the 1920s, like Blind Lemon Jefferson, Bessie Smith, and Charlie Patton, are first and foremost recordings and have only a secondary life as sheet music. Indeed, many did not appear in sheet music in form until decades later. I must reiterate, however, that in the popular blues culture of the 19-teens, examples like Livery Stable Blues are rare. Indeed, the other exceptions consist largely of works recorded by jazz bands in the wake of the original Dixieland jazz band, such as the prolific Louisiana Five. Having discussed the general scope and nature of early popular blues, I move to the second part of my paper on the origins of W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. And at this point, I'm going to move to the piano.
I have to talk loudly, which I'm now doing. So, St. Louis Blues. I do not think this work will need introduction to anyone here. It is not only the most famous blues produced in my period, it was written in 1914, but one of the most successful popular songs ever composed. For instance, Tom Lord's jazz discography lists nearly 1,500 recordings of the work, making it the most recorded composition in the history of jazz. St. Louis Blues is a truly remarkable song, and in my book, Long Lost Blues, I discuss it at some length. My focus today, given our location, is the connection between the theme of this chorus and of an earlier blues-related work, not written by Handy, called I Got the Blues, published in 1908 here in New Orleans by its composer, Antonio Maggio. Let us first familiarize ourselves with the chorus of Handy's masterpiece. Maggio's work is a piece of piano ragtime in three sections or strains and has long been acknowledged as a milestone in the history of blues in that its first strain is built on a 12-bar blues sequence. This is in itself exceptional for such an early date, 1908. But even more interesting is the fact that this is the first known instance in print of the blues sequence being associated with the notion of having the blues through the work's title, I Got the Blues. I'm now going to play the relevant strain for you. I will now isolate its melody, which I will place alongside the melody of the chorus of St. Louis Blues. You will hopefully hear a certain connection. Both are 12-bar melodies, sharing the same harmonic sequence and the same key, G major. However, there are specific parallels between the two. First, there is the fact that the two extracts are based on the same three-note motif. So here is the first phrase of Handy's melody. And I should say, when I'm playing these, I'm playing them very literally from the sheet music. When you normally hear St. Louis Blues, it's normally jazzed up a lot. It's not done literally like this. But this was how Handy originally conceived it, so I think it's a fair comparison. Let me just play that again. And here's the first phrase of Maggio's. Okay. Here's the second phrase of Handy's. The second phrase of Maggio's. And the ending of Handy's and Maggio's. So what is to be made of this relationship? There is enough in common between these two melodies to suggest that Handy's melody may have been in some way influenced by Maggio's. With the evidence I have so far presented, however, this remains just a possibility. After all, the similarity between the two could be just coincidental, or they might have been independently derived from the same folk source. There is, however, an additional piece of musical evidence that effectively proves a link between the two works. The evidence concerns not St. Louis blues itself, but Jogo blues, another handy blues published the year before St. Louis blues, 1913. This is a piece of piano ragtime, unlike St. Louis blues, which is a song, which is nowadays best remembered for the fact that its first strain uses the chorus theme of St. Louis blues, the one I played. Let me just get that clear. The Jogo blues, published a year before, uses the same theme as the St. Louis blues. We are, however, concerned not with that theme, but with the theme of the second strain of Jogo blues. The opening of this strain bears a remarkable resemblance to a passage in Maggio's work, not from his first strain, which is the bluesy one, and the one we've been discussing up till now, but from his third strain, which is usually ignored because it isn't bluesy. Not only are the melodies for these passages from Jogo blues and Maggio's strikingly similar, but they are treated in an almost parallel fashion over essentially the same chord sequence. Let me play those little sections for you now. This is Handy's Jogo Blues, second strain, the beginning of the strain. And here's the beginning of the third strain of Maggio's work. The motif that the two passages is based on, that's common to both passages, da 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 da, is not one that was in common currency at this time. Indeed, I know of no other work that uses it. In addition to this, both passages use a device which is exceptionally rare in piano ragtime and blues, the placing of the melody in the left hand underneath the accompaniment. This occurs in all four measures of Jogo blues. There's the melody. And it's in my left hand. And the last two measures of Maggio's. And if I just compare the two melodies alongside, and I'm just playing a slight little trick, which is I'm transposing one of the melodies, to emphasize the similarity, you will hear that they're really remarkably similar. His hand is. And here's Maggio's. I got the blues probably influenced one other distinctive aspect of St. Louis blues, its key structure. And here I apologize for having to get a little bit technical in my discussion. As is conventional in ragtime, Maggio's first strain, that's the bluesy one, returns later in the work. However, when it returns, it does so in a different key, G minor, rather than the G major original, and a relationship that musicians call the tonic minor, okay, if you hang on to that phrase. And it sounds, to our ears, it sounds pretty weird. Here's the original. When it returns, it does so like this. The tonic minor relationship is very rarely found in vernacular music, as its effect is rather jarring, as I hope you just heard. Instead, a different kind of major minor relationship is used, called the relative minor rather than the tonic minor, which sounds a lot smoother when you go from one to the other. In fact, now the only other work of vernacular music that I can think of that uses the same tonic minor relationship between sections, G major to G minor, is, you've guessed it, St. Louis Blues. It does exactly that. And St. Louis Blues does that as we go into the second section of the work, with the words, the section that goes, St. Louis woman's with her diamond ring, she got that man by her apron strings, that goes, the end of the previous section is, and we suddenly get this minor, comes in this tonic minor. It certainly sounds jarring when Handy uses it, but that is precisely the effect that Handy is after. The dramatic key change and rhythmic shift brilliantly encapsulate the exotic seductiveness of the other woman who has stolen the singer's man with her diamond rings and store-bought hair, as does the rhythmic shift to the tango rhythm as well. Maggio claimed much later on that Handy had heard his work on a visit to New Orleans and that this in turn influenced Handy's writing of St. Louis Blues. While it seems almost certain that Handy did not visit New Orleans at this time, it is entirely plausible that he encountered the work in Memphis, where he had lived since 1905, either in sheet music form or played by an itinerant band or musician from the Crescent City. It is interesting that Handy, in his only known discussion of Maggio's claim, a letter written to the composer William Grant Still, does not explicitly deny having encountered the work. This does not suggest that Handy was guilty of plagiarism. The inexact nature of the correspondences between the two passages in the two works suggests that the borrowings were unconscious on Handy's part. I Got the Blues was just one of hundreds of pieces, folk and commercial, he must have experienced during this period. It was encountered by him and probably made a particular impression because of its use of the 12-bar sequence and perhaps also because of its blues title. It then re-emerged in a creatively worked form from his unconscious at a later date. Such a phenomenon is in fact part of the normal creative processes of a composer, but it is particularly so for a composer like Handy, who was used to drawing on pre-existent material like folk music in his compositions. And while the evidence I have given strongly points to a connection between the two works, that connection in no way serves to undermine the legitimacy of Handy's masterpiece. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. That was terrific. I wish we had time for questions, but we have to move on.